This is an ABC podcast.
Locals say land clearing to accommodate a housing boom in Gympie in Queensland is leaving the koala population vulnerable.
When I looked out the window, I couldn't believe that actually there was somebody there pushing down all these trees. I was really concerned because there's koalas living over there, and if all the residents in this area would know that there's koalas there.
And we visit the Big Gala at Kimber, which marks the halfway point between East and West Australia.
I did get a lot of comment from people in Kimber when I said I was going to build the Big Gala. He said, you don't need to build that. You're a Big Gala yourself. So.
I'm Sinead Mangan, and this is Australia Wide. Peak Rural health bodies say a slow vaccination rollout for rural health workers could compromise healthcare services in the bush. The Rural Doctors Association and the Australian College of Rural and Remote Medicine are urging that people working in some of the most remote communities in Australia need to be prioritised when it comes to accessing the Pfizer vaccination. Dr. Chalmers, given the vulnerability of people in remote communities and the stretched services in the bush, why are people working in rural health not fully vaccinated at this point?
I think it's fair to say that initially there were really good plans to roll out the vaccine across the whole country. And I said on a number of occasions how happy we were that rural and remote had been taken into consideration. It was initially prioritisation that frontline health workers would be vaccinated, you know, before the general public. However, again, with the changes with the AstraZeneca safety concerns, that is now that's been changed, and so the prioritisation of healthcare workers has fallen into the same prioritisation group as other members of the community. And so it's actually very difficult for practitioners to access vaccines.
Dr. Sarah Chalmers, what is the rate of vaccination amongst those workers?
So we don't actually know the answer to that. I think it's fair to say that we don't know exactly the rates of vaccinations across the entire healthcare workforce, because it's not mandatory there isn't actually anybody counting. So we know that there have been, significant issues with health staff, even in big cities, and even working in hospitals that are treating COVID patients who are not vaccinated. So there isn't actually a register, so we don't know exactly how many people are not vaccinated.
Would you say there is hesitancy amongst regional health workers to get vaccinated? Have you, anecdotal evidence of that?
So I don't, but, people who work within the health industry are normal people. And so certainly initially the concerns around the safety with the AstraZeneca vaccine, I think there were quite a few people who were worried about that. I think there's a lot more information available to us now, but I'm sure that there are some health workers out there who for their own reasons may be not keen to get vaccinated.
I know hindsight is, it's a wonderful thing, but when you look back 12 months ago, you thought you were on a particular path, and you said that you've obviously it's shifted gears and it's not where you'd like it to be. Did this just get too complicated?
It certainly is very complicated. And I think that that's probably one of the reasons that, we've ended up in this situation, which, is that we've got a whole bunch of very vulnerable healthcare workers who aren't vaccinated. And the consequences of that, so, it's always worth, we talk a lot about risk these days. While in rural and remote communities, our level of risk for actually getting the virus is much lower than it is in places like Sydney and Melbourne, where they have international flights coming in, which we know has been, the source of the particular variants that we have at the moment. So we're far away from where those cases are coming in and from the hotels where people are being quarantined. So that's low risk. But what's of concern is that often these health services are really small, very fragile, and it only takes one person to be quarantined through a concern of exposure, or if somebody actually gets sick, an entire health service, you know, could actually fall over in a rural and remote community, and their access to other health services, you know, there'll be large distances to cover to access other health services. So it's of significant concern.
So that's the risk, and that's the problem in terms of moving towards a solution. What are you asking for?
What I would say, first of all, is that we're not actually saying that places like Sydney at the moment shouldn't be considered a priority. What we are saying is that we actually need to make the vaccination of our rural and remote health workers and other people who work within the health services, we need to make sure that they are as COVID-proof as possible before a significant outbreak. And definitely having fully vaccinated healthcare workers is part of that. So we always talk about, and particularly in primary care, that prevention is always better than cure. And so getting vaccinations out there is really important.
Dr. Sarah Chalmers, the President of the Australian College of Rural and Remote Medicine. Thanks very much for talking to Australia Wide.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
As we've just heard, the COVID-19 outbreak in New South Wales, as it worsens, urgency builds to roll out vaccines to priority and at-risk groups. The latest data shows more than 11.5 million doses of vaccines have been administered across the country. But should towns and regions be told what the vaccination rate is like in their local area? Christopher Testa has this story.
The quiet western Victorian town of Dunkeld is a long way from any current COVID outbreaks, but its residents are very interested in the progress of the vaccination rollout. Rural Council's Victoria Chair Marianne Brown lives there, and she says people in country areas are tired of going in and out of lockdowns and see vaccination as the way out.
I think people would like to get a sense of what the take-up has been, and it's difficult to access that information. I think it's partly about giving, if there's a reasonably high level of vaccination in communities, it gives people, I think, a greater sense of safety. But that information is not readily available at present.
The federal government does publish geographical data on the vaccine rollout, but that's only limited to figures by state and territory. Bill Botell, a strategic health policy expert from the University of New South Wales, says the data should be published by postcode as well, so governments can be held to account, particularly as the New South Wales government redirects Pfizer from country areas to help protect Year 12 students in high-risk suburbs in Sydney.
The figures will reflect the truth about what's been happening, but if we have the truth, we can put the pressure on and make the changes that are necessary to allocate the vaccines openly and transparently to where now in Sydney, in the worst crisis in the history of New South Wales, these vaccines have to be allocated to where they're most needed.
Dr. Jessica Kaufman from the Murdoch Children's Research Institute says localised vaccination data could improve transparency and maybe even encourage more people to get vaccinated. But she says if the data is too local, the risks could outweigh the benefits.
You know, we have insufficient supply at the moment and potentially uneven distribution of supply. And so there may be areas that are would have very low coverage. And if you publish that information without sort of all of the nuance as to why that might be the case, we run the risk of people in the public and particularly in the media labeling those areas or judging those areas as being full of anti-vaxxers, which is a really problematic issue and could be something where you end up sort of creating an unproductive competition or resentment between specific areas.
The federal government says it's considering ways it can add to the data it publishes on the rollout, but so far it's sticking to the format agreed at National Cabinet. Rural Doctors Association of Victoria President Rob Fair says his organisation could have a use for more localised data, particularly if there was a metro versus regional breakdown.
I think it would help us as an organisation advocate better for rural areas, and if we knew where there was a bit of a where there's less access or where public health units weren't quite reaching out as far as they could, we could better target those areas and advocate for the community there.
Dr. Rob Fair, President of the Rural Doctors Association of Victoria, ending that story from Christopher Testa.
You're listening to Australia Wide on ABC Radio.
And you've joined me, Sinead Mangan. For patients in intensive care, the strict New South Wales lockdown has also meant family can't visit them in hospital. As a result, nurses are often having difficult conversations with family members, such as end of life, over the phone. But a group of tech-savvy nurses in Wollongong have co-opted virtual reality to bring patients closer to friends and family. Hamish Cole has the story.
COVID restrictions in Greater Sydney has meant all in-person visitations for hospital patients have been banned to mitigate the spread of the virus. As a result, a group of ICU nurses at Wollongong Hospital have created a virtual video system to ensure families and intensive care patients stay connected throughout the pandemic. ICU nursing manager Bernadine O'Brien spoke about where the idea came from.
We identified during our lockdown in 2020 and the restrictions that were placed back then on the visiting that the impact on families and staff was huge at the time. In the ICU, we look after people in their most vulnerable states who are critically unstable, and often we're having to have very difficult conversations, including end-of-life conversations, over the phone with families, and we found that devastating for everyone.
The system has played a major role in reducing stress for nurses.
It's definitely had a calming effect on the nursing staff, but it reduces their stress level in having to say no, sorry, you can't visit. You know, that has a huge impact on the nursing staff. We're all human. We've all got families, and we know that we would hate to be told that we couldn't visit one of our loved ones. By no means is there any substitute for having someone physically at the bedside with their loved one, but you know, this has just made it that little bit easier for those people being able to access their family members.
Bedside nurse Agatha Friday says the system is giving families greater involvement in their loved ones' recovery.
And it just has created some empowerment for our patients' families, allowing them to decide when they want to visit and how they want to visit and who wants to visit their family members. It's been a really beautiful experience as a bedside nurse to use the system. I've had families sit and read the newspaper with their loved ones, have their morning coffee with their family members, the things that you miss so much that you do with your family while they're in hospital. And that was something that we couldn't even provide before this system. We had open and flexible visiting, but that casual interaction that you value so much about your special people in your life is something that we can replicate as much as possible now with the How Are You system. It's also really been quite successful in relieving families' worries about their patients in our unit. We've been able to get rid of that imagination that's always so much worse than the reality of being a patient in hospital by showing them on video. So that's been quite a relief for people to be able to really see what's going on with their family members while they're in intensive care.
Bernadine says the system has a significant role to play in the future.
We had really positive responses from the families that we offered this system to, and now we offer it to most people that come through the unit. And they've said to us that they feel really connected, and people have made comments like, you know, I could reach out and touch them. That's how close they feel when they are brought into the space. And we've had family interactions from all over Australia and the world. You know, it's a service that can be offered to anyone. It's not just about COVID. It's about having access. You know, some people just can't come into the hospital in normal times. For whatever reason, they might be unwell. They might have no transport, or they might be working. So they can access this system and still be able to visit their loved one.
What a great initiative. Wollongong ICU nurse Bernadine O'Brien and Agatha Friday, and they were speaking there to Hamish Cole about a virtual reality system that they've brought into Wollongong that brings patients and families close together. An environmental group is calling on the Southeast Queensland Council to reinstate protections against land clearing to protect koalas. As Meg Bolton reports, the group says hundreds of trees are being cleared around Gympie amid a housing boom in the region.
Crystal Wines used to be able to spot koalas near her home in Gympie. Now she's spotting bulldozers.
When I looked out the window, I couldn't believe that actually there was somebody there pushing down all these trees. I was really concerned because there's koalas living over there, and if all the residents in this area would know that there's koalas there.
Earlier this year, she filmed trees being toppled and thick bushland being cleared.
So I do fear for the animals that were living there prior to this clearing because, you know, I don't know where they've gone now or whether they're still alive or what's happened to them.
She thought it was illegal, but it wasn't. Last year, Gympie Regional Council revoked protections allowing clearing on large blocks of residentially zoned land. Gympie Region Mayor Glenn Hartwig says the council is acting in the best interest of the whole community.
The broader community have no issue with it. They understand that there is a need for residential growth, that human beings require housing, and that in this region we've got to find appropriate locations for people to build their homes.
Gympie Region Mayor Glenn Hartwig says the previous rules were unfair to investors who wanted to sell their land for future developments.
Well, the financial burden was that, you know, there were people that had bought those properties a considerable period of time ago that thought, hey, in 30 or 40 years' time, Gympie will have spread out to here and this will be my retirement fund. And they wanted the opportunity to develop that land for that purpose. And there was no compensation for them. Why should they carry the burden for everyone?
Wide Bay Burnett Environment Council Regional Engagement Coordinator Mike Moller says the change in rules has led to hectares of clearing.
At the moment, there are no controls in residential areas for land clearing. And so we're aware of at least six properties where clearing has occurred since then. You know, we're aware of on those six properties of at least 20 hectares. There's another 60 to 80 hectares of land involved in those properties, and people can just clear those at any time. We're also aware of another 50 hectares of property being advertised for sale, and the real estate advertisements are saying you can just, you know, you can develop this.
Council mapping shows more than 20 koala sightings since 2015, nearby to sites now cleared, and another 12 were sighted near a different block of land advertised for potential development. The state government has extra protection in place for koala habitat in southeast Queensland, from Noosa to the Gold Coast. But that protection doesn't cover the Gympie region, about 50 kilometres further north. Wide Bay Burnett's Environment Council's Mike Moller says he wants those protections extended to the Gympie region.
Gympie is facing pressures, as is southeast Queensland. Yes, there will be urban development, but let's do proper planning and put the urban development in the right place. So it doesn't affect, you know, koala habitat.
Australia Zoo Wildlife Hospital veterinarian Dr. Rosemary Booth says land clearing was the underlying cause of most hospital admissions.
Koalas require a forest, not just eucalyptus trees, so they don't just eat. They also rest in trees with extra vegetation like melaleucas. They will also eat non-eucalypt trees. And they also require an ecosystem around them to have a healthy forest. So they don't just need koalas and eucalyptus trees, they need the birds, the insects, the bats to do the pollinating of the eucalyptus trees. The whole forest needs to be preserved.
She says the hospital treats up to 600 koalas each year, 40% of those admitted for disease, 30% hit by cars, and 10% were the victim of dog attacks.
Land clearing is underlying all of those problems. So when the habitat becomes less healthy and fragmented, then disease becomes more of an issue. So disease never is a problem all by itself. It is definitely connected to habitat loss and fragmentation. And then the exposure to roads, the koalas are having to cross roads, that's how they get hit by cars, and they're having to traverse people's backyards, and that's how they get attacked by dogs.
Australia Zoo Wildlife Hospital vet Dr. Rosemary Booth ending that story from Meg Bolton. And you can read more on that story on ABC Online.
You're listening to Australia Wide on ABC Radio.
The Big Gala sits on the side of National Highway 1 in Kimber in South Australia, a town that's just about halfway across Australia from east to west. Now, the Big Gala wasn't built by a big corporation or a council or a community association. It was built by a family of six who spent their savings and spare time building it. In the 90s, the Vennings owned a small souvenir shop on the highway and would see thousands of cars and trucks pass their town without stopping. Almost 30 years ago, Roger Venning started talking about building the Big Gala.
I did get a lot of comments from people in Kimber when I said I was going to build the Big Gala. He said, you don't need to build that, you're a Big Gala yourself. So we had used to have that was brought up a lot.
But building the Big Galah wasn't cheap for the Vennings. Even getting the plans drawn up cost them a bit of money back 30 years ago.
Reasonable amount. It cost $2,000 just to draw the plan of it. But then when we had the plan, we had something to go on.
But it was a family exercise and everybody pitched in to help out, even his boys Quinton and Al, who were away at trade school.
One was a panel bit, Alan, the oldest one. Another one, Quentin, he was actually doing the auto electrician trade. So both, they used to come home, and that's what I said, the school holidays is where we done it, because we had the help from them. And we do it a lot. I had her over there one Sunday night tying the bird wire on. She had those concrete things you used to twitch, and she had to sit inside, and she got down to the bottom of the tail, and it's pretty small in there.
Al was 18 when they started building the Big Galah, and his mates used to give him a bit of grief for it.
It was pretty crazy, and it was all stuffing up our weekends. So which of fiberglass, yeah, used to make you a little bit high every now and then. So that Mum and Dad did get told every now and then what we thought of their galah anyway.
But Al learnt a lot from building the Big Galah, including just how ambitious his dad had been.
So Dad said, oh, this is what I'm looking at, and this is how much, I don't know how he got onto this bloke, but this is how much fiberglass I need. And he said, I don't use that much in 12 months. And he said, how long is it going to take you? And Dad said, oh, we got school holidays, so the kids can help as well, so we're all going to we'll get in there and we'll fiberglass it. We'll use it all in the school holidays. He said, you're going to use that much? And he said, yeah, we'll get it done over school holidays. Anyway, we proceeded to learn how to fiberglass. I'd done a bit with me trade when I was panel beating, so I knew a little bit about fiberglassing, but I'd never done that much.
Nothing was going to stop the Vennings from getting that Big Galah front and centre on National Highway 1.
Worked out, we seen the local policeman, and he said, Dad said, oh, I want to shift that Galah down and stand it up. And he said, oh, hell, Rod, you're going to have to get a permit and ride it. You know, you have to write to Adelaide for the oversize, and you're going to have to get a permit to shift it and all that. And he said, oh, hell, that's going to take a bit. He said, look, I'll tell you something. He said, what's that? And he said, oh, before you get out of bed, he said, we'll have it down there. How's that? And he said, well, don't do that. He said, better off I come down and escort you. How's that? I'll use a police escort and I'll take you down. So that's how it ended up getting down. It flew from the shed up and Mum and Dad's down to the shop,
Then there's the big job of getting a giant 2.5-ton galah from a shed a few streets over to their shop on the highway.
After spending all that, I think it took us about 18 months to build it from start to finish. And it took a fair bit of time, so all we wanted to do was see this thing put up in place anyway. We got down there the next morning after we'd shifted it down with a crane, and when we got it down there, sure enough, Jim had it hooked up and he got it up and he got it 3/4 away, and then it wouldn't go any further, the crane. So there's this thing hanging in midair, and Dad said, did you put it? Oh, he said, I forgot to put that oil in, get the rams to fully extend. So it was low on hydraulic oil, and that's why once we put the hydraulic oil, which he was supposed to do that in the night before, but he didn't, old Jim. So we got it, this thing was suspended 3/4 up, and all we wanted to do was see it bolted to the ground so it didn't fall. That was a little bit nerve-wracking because we thought, this is going to be good. A big wind will come and it'll blow, and then the crane will fall over and everything will crash and we'll be back building again, and there's no way we wanted to do that.
But Roger was never going to let that galah drop.
From the shed to the shop was, like he said, we had to get the police escort, but I made sure that where I had it hooked up at the back of the... It was like on the back of his neck. I had two chains, so I didn't want it to break because I knew if it fell, she'd make a fair mess. Then it was hanging there for about an hour while I went and got some oil and all that. And then when he got the oil, she lifted the full height and we lifted onto the tripod thing. We had all the base was actually just had to match it. And as from today, what we did on the bottom, we covered it with... it's oily rag you put around the bolts, so if ever we wanted to shift it, we knew when we took all the cement and that away from the bottom, we could shift it. It could be just shifted, there's no problem.
But the Big Galah is set to stay, and at 30 years old, it's getting a revamp soon, and Roger's happy to see it taken care of. He's proud of what he and his family created and getting people to stop in Kimber halfway across Australia.
Oh, it certainly increased people stopping. and coming in. That was one of the main things. And then people taking photos. If I had 10 cents for every photo, I'd be pretty rich.
What a great yarn. Roger Venning ending that story from Angela Smolicombe and Jodie Hamilton. And that's Australia Wide for tonight. I'm Sinead Mangan. I hope you have a lovely evening. Cheerio.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.